Okay, hello everyone, and welcome to the 12th episode of our podcast, The World of Heritage. We are the students and lecturers of the World Heritage Studies program at the Brandenburg Technical University, and this podcast is for our study project for this semester. I'm Caitlin Williams, I'm the lecturer for the study project, and I organized the course titled Queering the Narrative, the Role of Subcultural and Marginalized Communities in Reshaping the Heritage Landscape, in order to work on communities and narratives that are important to them. I have the great pleasure of being here today with our wonderful hosts, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks, Caitlin, so much for this nice introduction. About Caitlin. Caitlin was born and raised in New York. She did her undergrad degree in journalism and mass communication with a minor in history and cinema studies at the New York University. In 2011, she attended the New York University School of Continuing and Professional Studies in the field of architectural history, where she began to fall in love with heritage. She then decided to change careers and the first step was starting her master's degree at the BTU in World Heritage Studies. During her master's studies, she and a few of her fellow students planned and managed an exhibition with the name World War Heritage in Cottbus. Furthermore, she and a team of other students wrote a research paper regarding the development of an effective buffer zone for the archaeological site Göbekli Tepe. She wrote her master thesis about the Teufelsberg Historic Site, a preliminary interpretation plan, part of which was also published in a book from Professor Leo Schmidt and Professor Alexandra Schetzun-Safir with the name Forschen, Bauen, Erhalten, Jahrbuch 2014-2015. Caitlin is also a member of the Association of Critical Heritage Studies, the U.S. National Committee of ICOMOS, and the Interpret Europe, just to name a few. She's currently doing her PhD in the World Heritage Studies at the BTU. Additionally, during the last couple of years, she has worked as a lecturer at the Helwan University and the BTU, and is currently also an academic staff member of the Chair of Architectural Conservation at the Brandenburg Technical University. Wow, what impressive achievements. This is just a short introduction to start off our talk, and therefore we would like to welcome Caitlin again. Hi, Caitlin, and welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting our invitation and your support and advice along the way for promoting this podcast. So let's get started with the first round of our questions. Caitlin, why did you decide to study journalism and mass communication for your undergrad, and how did you switch from the area of journalism to heritage field?
Okay, so I'm going to warn you, this is going to be a long, complicated answer, but I hope it will be somewhat satisfying. Journalism and mass communications was an interesting choice for me in the beginning. I love to write. I thought in the beginning I might want to go into creative writing, but then I realized I have more of a talent for being straightforward and cutting to the point. And I also really enjoyed interacting with people and doing what I thought was more research or investigation. So I thought it would be a good combination. And I really liked learning, studying journalism at NYU in particular. They have a great course there for journalism with great professors who have worked in the field and are able to give you the real inside understanding of how to operate in the field. And I enjoyed it a lot. I also thought I might be able to combine it. I'm a huge fan of film and television. So I thought maybe one day I could combine those two interests and think about film criticism. So that's where the cinema studies minor came in. And history minor was just because I was interested. And then after university, I did work at a magazine. I did some freelance writing and I enjoyed it. But I realized that especially in the US, it's a tough field to break into if you don't have sort of outside resources. So I wanted to find a job that was a little bit more stable, that I would have health insurance, and that I would have a more clear career path. So I made what seemed to be a strange transition into investigations. But to me, it didn't seem strange. It seemed strange to those on the outside, but to me, it made perfect sense because it was using the same skills. So I got a job at the Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City. And that is a government agency that investigates police misconduct. So when people would complain about being on the other end of abuse from the NYPD, from the New York City Police Department, then we would investigate those complaints. And that could be anything from abusive language to physical abuse to search and seizure infractions. So if a police officer searches you without having the right to do so, we would go and investigate that. And I ended up being correct in that it was the same skills. Basically, investigation is a lot like reporting, where it required interviewing, it required finding the people who would be able to give me the information I needed to understand what had happened, documentary evidence, video evidence, and then taking all of that and trying to make sense of what happened and then collating it into a final report. So it was a really good, strange use of the skills that I had learned in university. But what I had found in that experience was that, you know, I interviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of civilians in New York City who had negative experiences with the police. And I interviewed just as many, if not more, police officers. And you always interviewed them separately and then tried to come to a finding about the allegation. So what the civilian alleged to have happened, you write a report and then it's out of your hands. But in listening to both sides, I heard a lot of information or a lot of stories and feelings that weren't being addressed in these investigations. So all I could do is, okay, this was supposedly happened. And then I would do my best to figure out if it happened and if the police officers were in the wrong. So if they did something they weren't supposed to do, and then I make a recommendation for punishment. But in the stories that I was hearing people, I live in this neighborhood, the police are here all the time, they don't respect me, you know, all of my dad, my grandpa, we all have had these issues, we don't like the police, we don't trust them. And on the other side, the police sort of, oh, we go into these neighborhoods, they don't like us, we do our best, we do what we can. And all of these elements weren't being addressed. And I felt like, okay, what I'm doing right now is important, but I feel like there's this much deeper historical issue that isn't being addressed. And so I started, you know, thinking more and more about how these types of issues might be addressed, how we might actually dive into the history of these interactions between the police and civilians and try to come to an understanding together and move forward and try to heal. And so I felt like, you know, the more I did some research about how that might be done, I realized heritage was one way that that could happen. So if we look at history and we dive into it together, we think of it critically together, you know, we don't just take the surface level of our interactions today, but we realize how they're informed by history. That might be one way to actually heal in a deeper way. So I remember having to explain this to people and I never figured out how to explain it in a shorter way, because to me it made perfect sense, but I had to kind of bring everyone on each step towards my switch to heritage. But that's the best way I can explain it, that I felt like, you know, what I was doing was important, but I felt like there was a different and more effective role that I personally could play with my interests and my experience. So then the next step was just, okay, well, how do I make this happen? And doing a lot of research online and finding the World Heritage Studies program and, you know, seeing what people were doing with heritage, both in the program and after they complete the program. And I decided to go for it, see if I could make it work.
After you finished your coursework at the BTU, you went back to New York and started a job as an assistant manager of public programs at the New York Historical Society. How come and could you include the things you learned at the BTU into your daily work life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The how come was a mix of experience and luck. So when I finished my coursework, I was actually still writing my master thesis, but I came back to New York to try to get some professional experience at the same time, so that once I was finished with my master thesis, I would have a foot in the door for a future career. And the first thing that I did was, before even New York Historical Society, was intern at Brooklyn Historical Society. So for those unfamiliar with the museums of New York, or the smaller museums of New York, Brooklyn Historical Society is a nonprofit museum and research library located in Brooklyn, and it's focused more on Brooklyn history. So Brooklyn is a borough within New York City, and it's a really progressive institution. It actually has recently been taken into the Brooklyn Public Library system, but it's still doing the important work that it's always been doing, in that it's trying to connect the history of the borough itself to today's Brooklynites. So trying to make it relevant, trying to tell the stories from Brooklyn history that aren't always told, but that are important to the different communities that exist there now. And I interned in the education department and thought it was an incredible experience, just trying to show the youth of Brooklyn how interesting their borough's history is, and how there are actually a lot of people in the past that might look like them or might have similar experiences to them, and really shaped the city into the place we know it today. So that is what I was doing alongside my thesis. And then through that job, I made a connection with an old friend. His name is Alex Castle, who worked at New York Historical Society. And I was telling him, you know, the experience I had in my master's degree and the experiences I was getting at Brooklyn Historical Society. And he thought I would be a good fit for New York Historical Society, where he worked in the public programs department, because he saw that I really liked to kind of find ways to bring history to the public, to make history engaging for public audiences, and to, you know, make it something that people are interacting with in their regular lives. So he, you know, recommended me for the job. I went through a whole interview process and was lucky enough to land the job. And it was a great experience. And, you know, it's interesting trying to think of, you know, how my coursework would have prepared me for that job. I think there were a lot of moments when, especially in study projects, where I had to, you know, develop, I don't remember the title because it was many years ago, but it was a study project with Britta Rudolph, and I had to develop an event for a public audience, and I had to figure out how to raise money for the event, what kind of programming we would have at the event, how we would get people in Cottbus to come to the event. So it was from start to finish planning a program. And, you know, at that point, it was brand new to me. And so remembering, you know, all that it took at that time, and trying to bring that experience to New York Historical Society, where, you know, I was planning a program on a different scale. It was a really good experience to have as a foundation for that type of work. So yeah, there were definitely a lot of moments in World Heritage that I felt at least gave me a little bit of experience to have the confidence to do that in a professional setting. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for all your explanation about the path that you were led to. Why did you decide to go back from being a practitioner to become a lecturer at the university?
Well, it's another mix of circumstances and interest. So I had stayed in touch with Professor Leo Schmidt, and I had worked with him a lot at BTU during the master program. And usually it had everything to do with the broad topic of heritage and conflict. So, you know, you mentioned the exhibition that I planned with a couple fellow students titled World War Heritage. And that was sort of the beginning of that process. And that was something that we had planned as a part of a study project that looked at this wide topic. And that was partly in connection with the two anniversaries. So I believe it was the 75th anniversary of World War II and the 100th anniversary of World War I, the start of World War I. And so he gave us a lot of freedom with exploring the topic. And the exhibition was something that we can kind of pour all of our interest and research into. And it was a really, really good experience. And then working with him on a topic like that in the study project led me to work with him as well. He was my supervisor for my master thesis. And I was looking at a different war, the Cold War, a very different type of war with very different physical traces and our understandings of those physical traces. And so, you know, taking a deep dive into a specific site related to the Cold War and how, you know, we can use this physical site, the Teufelsberg, as to gain a deeper understanding of what was going on during the Cold War was another really, really interesting experience. And, you know, if I could have, I would have continued with it. But, you know, I ended up on a slightly different path going back to New York, ending up working for the museums, really good professional experience. But after a few years, Professor Schmidt started to develop a new research project. It was very much connected to what was going on in Syria at the time. And so what his hopes were to bring young and less experienced and more experienced researchers together to dive into what might be done in Aleppo specifically, once at that point, this was a few years ago, once the fighting ended. So there were a few colleagues who I ended up having from Syria who looked specifically at Aleppo, trying to make plans for the heritage there after the fighting. And my role was to look at past cases of heritage destruction during conflict to see what had been done, to see if there's any ideas that, you know, we can sort of cull from these previous experiences. And so he had this PhD position open for someone who might want to take that on. And because of, you know, us working together in the past and him knowing my interest and my experience in this type of research, he asked me to apply and to, you know, to develop a research proposal that might fit within this research project. And so I don't think that if this opportunity arose that I would have went back to academia when I did, but this was an opportunity I couldn't turn down, and especially working with someone who I respect and who I still feel like I could learn so much from, and who I know I work well with. So it was really dependent on the opportunity that was presented to me. And I'm really glad I did. The lecturing was another unexpected path. Earlier in my PhD career, I was offered an opportunity to assist with a study project, and I really enjoyed the experience. So every other chance I got to lecture or to help with developing or teaching classes and study projects, I took it. And so I was just lucky enough last year to be offered a position at the chair where one of my main responsibilities is lecturing. So it was a lot of circumstance, honestly, really good circumstances that I'm glad, you know, arose. And I'm glad that I was able to follow this path and come back to Germany, and specifically BTU, because I've always had really good experiences at the university.
Thanks for answering so far. We will take a short break and we will be back in a few seconds.
Hi again. We will start the second round of our interview with Caitlin, talking more about the life in Germany. Caitlin, when moving to Germany the first time, did you experience a big difference between the American and the German lifestyle and culture? And what have you missed the most from New York life?
Okay, so I felt, especially the first time, that differences were less, the differences that I noticed the most had less to do with German and American culture per se, and more with moving from a big city like New York to a smaller city like Cottbus. I mean, the most obvious I can, you know, thing I can say is the variety and opening times of stores, which was fine. You know, in New York, even in, you know, all the parts of Brooklyn where I lived, you can get whatever you want, whenever you wanted it, even on Sundays. So I think it took me like a few months to get used to, you know, the everything is closed on Sunday rule. There were many, many times where I did not get the groceries that I needed. And then on Sunday, woke up in the morning, was like, oh, yep, did it again. But, you know, once you get used to that, it's not a big deal. And it's actually quite nice to have that one day a week where everyone's kind of relaxing and on the same page. But also, you know, I had lived in New York for so long that, you know, I had a huge community set up there. Most of my university friends were still there. We were like a little family. We had our routines, you know, almost every week I was going to the theater. So I think the biggest difference was, you know, changing from this big city where I have this huge community and a lot of sort of cultural events that I was able to attend, to going to this smaller place where I had to start afresh, especially with, you know, a community. And World Heritage Studies obviously made that a lot easier because we were a small group. I think we were about 30 people, and we were mostly all living in Cottbus. So we sort of formed this tight-knit group very quickly. But it was still, you know, interesting because in New York, you never, ever can get bored. You know, there's so much to do, so many museums, so many cultural events, that there's always something to sort of fix your social life around. Where in Cottbus, it's still the case. We still have lovely theater. We have, you know, plenty of restaurants, a few really cool bars, but I feel like we also had to get a little bit creative. So there were a lot of evenings where we were, you know, in someone's dorm or in someone's vague. We had one night where we would, you know, bring it wasn't exactly poetry. Some people could bring poetry. They could bring what they wanted, something cultural to share with each other. And that was something that I don't think I had ever really made the time to do with my friends in New York. So it really brought us closer together very quickly. So that was definitely one difference that didn't seem positive at first, but ended up being really positive. And I know we had discussed this, and I've discussed this with a million other people. But yeah, in New York, especially where I had been living before moving to Germany the first time, I didn't have any parks. It was definitely extremely urban. And so going to Cottbus with, you know, so much green space, so much open air. I remember the first week in Cottbus, I did a tour with the BTU with international students where we were canoeing in the Spreewald. And that was just a hop, skip, and a jump away from where we were living. And it was so amazing to have access to this gorgeous nature all of a sudden without having to, you know, spend so much money and spend 2 hours on a train. We just were in the Spreewald and within half an hour canoeing down the Spree. So I think most of it was great. The one negative thing is that I really love bagels. So this is something any New Yorker will tell you, that even when they go to other parts of the United States, the bagels, the pizza, the bacon and egg sandwiches, there are just these like specific types of New York food that are really cheap. So as you know, as a young person, when I was still living in New York, this is what I ate, because, you know, you go to the bagel store, you spend $3 and you get a bagel with cream cheese. And I still to this day, I miss bagels and New York pizza. So that was the one thing that I definitely still miss. And my friends, of course, but you know.
During your master studies, you were living in Cottbus. What have you found so special about Cottbus?
Good question. I really loved, so I went to New York University, as you said in my intro, and that university is very much like embedded within New York City. So we don't have a specific campus. The buildings are, you know, there are a lot of buildings in one specific neighborhood in New York, but really they're all over the place. The dorms are all over the place. And a lot of people who go to NYU are really independent. So they go to their classes, but they form their own lives. So there isn't a lot of university life. And what I really like about BTU is the campus and how, you know, you have the Mensa where everyone goes for lunch. A lot of times after class, I remember everyone just going to Mensa together and hanging out and relaxing. And I remember the university parties in a time where we could still have parties publicly were really great, because it just felt like we had this big community in the heart of Cottbus. And I really liked that. But in terms of the city itself, I just think it's a really interesting mix of architecture, first of all. So that was interesting as someone who, you know, was studying heritage and was becoming more and more interested in the history of architecture, just looking at the different layers of history that you could see in Cottbus. I really liked living in a apartment. When I first moved to Cottbus, I lived in a Vega that was in an apartment building that was built during, you know, GDR times, and seeing, then going to my other friends' apartments and seeing how similar, you know, you could see all of the similar elements, because it had this sort of, it was the type of apartment that was built all over the GDR. So you could recognize similar elements in all of them. So I thought that was interesting, and learn more about the development of these types of like bigger apartment buildings. I really liked that you could walk everywhere. I loved walking into the Altmarkt, going to the cafe on lunch breaks, that type of thing. And then just a step further, you're like running along the river. I run very regularly. I run 4 to 5 times a week, and running in Cottbus was wonderful. Whether it's through the Altmarkt and seeing, you know, the history of Cottbus, or running along the Spree to Brannitz Park, it was, even though it's not a very big city, I wasn't wanting for adventures to go on my run. So yeah, I really liked living there. And I love visiting now when I, you know, I live in Berlin now, but I really love when we're able to, going to Cottbus, going to my office, going to the Mensa for lunch, walking around, seeing the sights. So I feel like it's a really special little place with a really, really nice community of students who also love it.
In the way that you find the heritage in your daily life in Berlin, without considering your academic perspective, what do you find in Berlin so special?
So similar to, you know, a little bit similar to what I said about Cottbus, you know, my favorite pastime, aside from I still love film and television, obviously, but what I like to do other than that, I really like going on runs and walks. And I feel like the times of Corona have made this even more important. And I usually will decide how to go on a walk based on something that I want to see. So something that I might not have seen before in Berlin. And there's so much history, and that's usually what I'm basing these walks around. So I might want to go on a walk where I can trace part of the Berlin Wall. You know, Professor Schmidt, who I talked about earlier, obviously has had a lot of interest in the Berlin Wall, and I've learned a lot from him. And it's interesting to hear from him about his research into the Berlin Wall, and then to go see the traces for myself. So maybe I haven't been to the Berlin Wall Memorial in a while, and I could walk over there and see it. Or, you know, maybe I want to learn a little bit more about, you know, the history of the Second World War in Berlin. There's always traces to be found. And, you know, maybe I might walk over to the Topography of Terror, or maybe I want to more reflect on the different communities that suffered during the war, and I might go see the Roma Memorial in Tiergarten. There's always something for every, especially 20th century history, for every era of 20th century history. And it's always hiding in plain sight. So even when I just go on a walk and I decide I just want to stroll around, I might, you know, walk by a few of the stumbling stones. So the smaller memorials to the victims of the Holocaust, especially a day like yesterday was Holocaust Remembrance Day, yesterday as from when this is being recorded. So seeing all of the different candles and flowers and different mementos that were left on these small personal memorials, and then just taking the time to, you know, bend down and look at the names and think about, you know, the people who lived here, what it might have looked like then, what they might have been through, what their lives might have been like. So I feel like as someone who's really interested in history, you can't really leave your door in Berlin without coming across something that will make you think a little bit deeper about it. And I really, really love that about Berlin. In New York, it's so much harder because I feel like everything is always about moving forward. And so you'll find traces of history, but they're fewer and far between. Whereas in Berlin, they're there, even if, you know, a lot has changed since the Second World War. I feel like the traces are still there. And when they are there, they're respected. And public history here is incredible. So I feel like the city and the different institutions do a great job of really sort of shining a light on all of these aspects of history, no matter how difficult they are. And they do it in a really thoughtful way. So I think that's really, really special. And again, I'm going to repeat, and I know, you know, many of your guests have talked about parks and green space, but also incredible. Like before I moved back to Berlin the second time, I was living in a neighborhood where I was 5 kilometers from the nearest park. And all the green spaces you see on a map were like asphalt basketball courts. So you think you're walking to a park and then it would be more concrete or asphalt. Whereas in Berlin, for instance, like if I run 4 times a week, even though we can't go very far from our homes right now because of the lockdown, I have 4 different parks that I can go to. And they're all beautiful in their different ways. So I have Volkspark Friedrichshain, Volkspark Prenzlauer Berg, and I feel like I am seeing something new every time I run, even in the green spaces. So that is just incredible. I don't know many other major cities that each neighborhood will have at least one park where you can go. So that's super special. And I just want to say one more thing about Berlin before, I know this is already very long, but I also really love how you don't really have to worry about what you look like, which sounds strange, but I just feel like there are so many, especially like bigger cities where, you know, everyone is sort of like looking at each other and dressing fancy, and you have to dress a certain way to go certain places. And of course, there are places in Berlin where you do want to look nicer, but for the most part, I don't have to worry about going to bar or going to a cafe and like dressing up. I could really dress how I am and no one will think twice about it. And that's a really nice, cool, because I'm pretty casual with that type of thing. So it's nice to know that I'm sort of amongst people who are also casual and aren't judging or expecting, you know, any sort of presentation. So it's really, I really like that about Berlin.
What do you think makes the BTU heritage community so special?
Well, I think, you know, one of the more obvious answers is the fact that, you know, people are coming from all over the world. So both personally and professionally, I feel like you're making connections that you would have never made otherwise. And professionally, it's great because, you know, if everyone's coming from a different place and has a different way of working, you can sort of learn other ways of doing things and sort of pick and choose what might work best for you. But also, you know, if you do want to work elsewhere, you have professional connections. Personally, I feel like I have met people who, again, I would have never met otherwise. And I'm so grateful that I have them as friends now. And that, you know, if I go to Taiwan, I have a place to stay and someone to kind of catch up with and show me around. And, you know, that's true of in Colombia and Canada, like all over. It's really nice to have these very personal connections and then to get to go to these places and not just learn about the places, but learn about your friends' lives there is really, really amazing. So I think that's the more obvious answer. I also think that people who are interested in heritage and culture have a certain mindset that make them really interesting and open. So I feel like if you're coming in with this interesting culture, and not only culture, but cultures that maybe aren't your own and trying to understand them, I feel like you come in more open to connecting with the people in the program. So I feel like it's a really great experience to be with a group of people who just really want to learn without judgment. And it leads to much deeper, more meaningful personal conversations and professional conversations. So I feel like those are the two things that make the usually, I mean, I know that was my experience in my master program, and I see it with the students now, that make it a really, really special experience.
Many thanks for sharing your experience and your thought with us. We need to take a short break and we will be back soon.
Welcome back with the third part of our talk. So now we will focus more on the study part. Caitlin, when you study World Heritage Studies, do you remember what did you like the most about the program? Your study year classmates? How many were you, and were they heading to the heritage career direction after graduation or more PhD?
So there were, I believe, about 30 of us. And quite a few actually ended up in the heritage field. I think everyone wanted to head in that direction. And, you know, some people had a few experiences, maybe internships, maybe, you know, initial jobs, and found something else they were more interested in. But there are quite a few. I know one of my former classmates and still good friends is working for the German UNESCO Commission, focusing on world heritage. So she's doing almost exactly what, you know, we are studying for in World Heritage Studies. I have another friend who's working for the archaeology department for Northern Germany, and he's actually working at very closely at an archaeological World Heritage site up north. So he's, again, doing almost exactly what we're trained to do. I know a few people who went and worked in Bahrain after the program. I know Britta Rudolph has a lot of connections there, and she sometimes helps people get positions there. And I know quite a few people who worked there for a few years, a few who are actually still there working in the heritage field in Bahrain. So yeah, actually, there are quite a few. I know a few of my other classmates also either are doing PhDs or did their PhDs. They took a few years to get some professional experience. And then a few of them actually came back to BTU as well to do their PhD in different facets of heritage. So a lot of people actually stayed in the field one way or another, whether as practitioners or as academics. So I thought that was really great. And I think what I enjoyed most about the program, well, it's hard to say because I loved my classmates. It was an amazing group. And I think that also led to incredible class experience because, as you two know, so many projects and classes require group work. So it's always, you know, working together with your classmates, whether it's on a group paper, a group presentation, or a more, you know, hands-on project. So I think really, really liking and connecting with your classmates is important because, you know, that enables you to work better together and work more effectively. And I know there are a lot of, you know, challenges that I was able to overcome with the help of my classmates, you know, the exhibition that I talked about earlier, you know, I didn't know anything about exhibition design at the time. And we had one student who was more experienced in that. So she brought her strengths, and you actually end up learning from your fellow students as well through this group work. That doesn't mean there weren't times, and I'm sure you two know this, where it could be really frustrating because, you know, everyone has different communication skills, communication and working skills. So learning how to work together when you have different ideas of how things should be done and how to approach different challenges is a challenge in and of itself. But I also felt like that was one of the best experiences because you really have to push through. None of my lecturers or professors, if, you know, we were having issues and we went to them, they said, okay, well, you have to figure out how to work together. And you really got the sense that that was a big part of, you know, the learning experience in the program. So even when it was frustrating, it ended up being a good experience and rewarding in the end. And I think that's what enabled a lot of my classmates also to kind of go and work in professional settings in places that, you know, might not be, you know, in their home country, but they have experience working with people from different cultural and professional backgrounds, and were able to sort of come at it with a very open-minded and professional approach. So that's probably, I mean, it's really hard to say like just one thing, but I think in general, the classmates learning how to work together was probably my favorite element of the program.
Excellent. As a lecturer and academic advisor for the chair of architectural conservation now, do you see a lot of differences between your studies year from 2011 and our studies today? I mean, kind of excluding Corona time.
Yeah, that's a good question. The first thing that comes to mind is how proactive, like in terms of the studies themselves, I know a lot of the courses, the course titles are the same, but what's good about World Heritage is that the lecturers, you know, are always open to, you know, adapting it as we have new discoveries in the field or new understandings in the field. I feel like lecturers are always trying to stay on top of that and to keep the course material relevant. So that's always going to shift a little bit. But what I notice the most is how proactive the students are. So I see the student council being really proactive, not only on a social level, but, you know, developing a conference where current and past and prospective World Heritage Studies students or practitioners can come and, you know, listen to other people who have gone through the program or who are still in the program or who are teaching for the program to hear their experiences and interact with them. And it was a really professionally run conference. And I was very impressed because I feel like the students are very much being thoughtful about their coursework, but also branching out and trying to make connections elsewhere in the heritage field. So bridging, you know, creating more bridges between BTU, the Heritage Studies program, and the rest of the Heritage Studies field. And I felt like, you know, as students, we had done some of that, but I feel like there's a lot more of that now. So, and the more bridges that are made between World Heritage Studies program and the professional field, the better, because those are more opportunities for people to see, you know, what can be done in the field later and how students can get involved now. So for instance, there's another conference that's going on right now that is being partially run by a former World Heritage Studies student, and World Heritage Studies students are presenting there. And I just think those types of things are really important. And there's a lot more of that now, which I really like to see, because it's just keeping the program relevant and expanding on that relevance. So that's really exciting to me. So it's probably the biggest difference. I think some of that was there when I was a student, but it's just expanding more and more, which is real. And Ian, even in Corona times, so I know you didn't want me to, you know, specifically address Corona times, but it's really nice to see that that's still happening. Students are still, you know, making connections in the field, even during this time. And then, you know, establishing those connections so that other World Heritage Studies students can benefit and have more opportunities.
Can you tell us about your PhD dissertation project in Bosnia? Have you also traveled to Bosnia for a closer look?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm looking at post-conflict heritage recovery in Bosnia. So heritage recovery after the war there from 1992 to 1995. And so what I'm looking at is primarily the social effects of heritage recovery. I'm analyzing it using the living heritage approach as a methodological tool. So looking at this idea of living heritage. So I'm looking mostly at religious heritage. So Islamic sacral heritage in Bosnia, which was targeted during the war for destruction. And I'm looking if these recovery projects also enabled these former structures to sort of regain their role in the social and religious lives of the communities that were affected. And yes, I have been to Bosnia several times. I did a few longer research trips there, lasting anywhere from 2 weeks to a few months, where I was conducting interviews with the citizens in the case study towns that I'm looking at. So I'm looking at a few case study towns, including Stolac, which is in the Herzegovina part of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Foča, which is in the eastern part of Bosnia. So I was really taking a closer look at both those structures that have already been reconstructed and how they're now being used. Like if there is now, both of those towns experienced ethnic cleansing. So the user communities for these mosques mainly had been either expelled or killed. So I'm looking to see whether or not these communities have since been revived since these structures have been reconstructed. And if so, are they using these structures? Are they using them in a similar fashion to the way they did before the war? How do they associate with these structures now? A lot of these structures were cared for by the local community. And so are these, you know, traditional methods of care revived as well? So not just looking at whether, you know, the structure itself and whether it's returned and how, you know, historically accurate the reconstruction is, but really looking at the revival, the role that the structure played in the lives of the communities. So yeah, it requires, you know, it required being there a lot, talking to a lot of people, making observations over time. So, I mean, I wish I could go back. I haven't been able to go for a while, obviously because of travel restrictions, but I mean, right now I'm in my writing phase. So actually my research travel visits are over for now anyway, which was, the timing worked out well for what has happened in the past year. But of course I miss it. So I would love to go back to Bosnia to see the people who I've gotten to know so well over the past years. So I will definitely be doing that as soon as I can. But luckily for my research, I've collected all the data I need and I'm in the writing phase.
We are already finished with the third part of our interview, and we are also want to ask you the last question, which is, what is your favorite World Heritage site and why?
Okay, well, I don't really have a favorite. So I'm just going to say the one that comes to mind. Oh man, it's hard because I really love Smoky Mountain National Park in the United States at this point in time, even though most of my work and research has to do with cultural heritage. This is a natural heritage site, but my family, you know, I'm from New York, but my family, since my parents retired, moved to Tennessee in the United, another state in the United States. And so home has come to be associated with Tennessee, strangely, because when I visit home, I think of my family, and my family is all in Tennessee. And they live right by the Smoky Mountains. And so I think of a lot of elements of that site that are really, really special. From just the view from my parents' house, they could see the Smokies. So I think of that when I think of, you know, visiting my parents, but also I connect the Smoky Mountains with true American hero, Dolly Parton, probably one of my favorite people who I don't know on this earth. She is fantastic. And so, you know, she comes from that region. So I think of that. I also think of, you know, all of the different history of the Cherokee tribe that was in and around the area in the past. And I try to, you know, think about their history and how, you know, how they shaped that land and how, you know, it has been shaped since, you know, that land was taken away from them. So try to remember that aspect of history. So I think it has a lot of layers of interest that just kind of bring together everything that's important to me, whether it's nature, hiking, you know, going on mountainous runs, or the music of Dolly Parton, and, you know, just different music from the region, the kind of layers of history that, you know, are sometimes forgotten in the US, but should not be forgotten, such as, you know, what happened to tribes like the Cherokee tribe. So I feel like it brings a lot of elements of interest together for me. So that's the first thing that came to mind. Don't hold me to it, but I think it's still a decent answer.
Great. Thank you so much again for taking your time and talking to us and agreeing to meet us online during this time of pandemic. It was a great pleasure for us. And we really loved having you and enjoyed listening to your explanations and your experience through all these years of being with BTU. We also wish you all the best for your future at the BTU and hope that you stay with us and the program for much longer. Furthermore, we wish you all the best with your PhD publications and a healthy stay with your family in Berlin.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This was really fun. I really enjoyed talking to you guys.
Thanks also to you guys, wherever you are right now, for listening to our short talk. We really did enjoy our interview and we hope you feel the same way and did learn some new things about another very special heritage community member. Next episode, we will talk to another important member. The next episode will already be our 13th episode of the World of Heritage podcast. And the guest of this episode will be our fellow student, Mora Laki Akin Alabi. She had the opportunity to attend a study trip to Italy, and we are excited to learn more about her view regarding the World Heritage Convention. By the way, did you already listen to the other 12 podcasts we published? For example, Anna's, Roger's, Helena's, or Isaac's? If not, you definitely need to do so. For also keeping up to date with our project, you can follow us on Instagram. Our name on social media is The World of Heritage. We would also appreciate your feedback. If you're interested in sharing your story on our podcast, feel free to contact us. You can find our email address in the description box below. Thanks again for listening and stay safe. Bye.